You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Matt Lewis, you sound so mellifluous in my ear. What's different today?
Oh, I'm using a new microphone.
Recommended by...
And let me just say, same thing, right? Now, now there's really no excuse. If you still sound better than me... There's not a lot of excuse for why that would be. We're using the exact same mic. And let me just say, when I set up my Patreon page, I set a goal. If I could get to a certain level, I would improve the quality of the audio for my podcast. And now we've met that goal. I bought a new microphone, my man.
It's a whole new era of the DMZ.
Well, this is a... This is a side benefit. You know, the Patreon supports Matt Lewis and the News podcast, so I'm going to have to charge the DMZ account a percentage for the use of this, I think, to comply with federal election law.
Right, the 5% of zero.
Yes. But thank you for the recommendation. I think it has first of all, it's a lot lighter than my old mic, which was 10 years old, and it wasn't that expensive. And I think it is an upgrade in terms of the I mean, I haven't listened to this, the DMZ yet, but on my podcast, I think it's an upgrade on the audio.
And mind you, no one's paying us because they never do. But for podcast geeks, this is an Audio Technica. I think it's an ATR 2500.
Well, let me just while I'm doing these shameless self promotions that are seamlessly tied in. I'd like to mention I just put out an ebook that that patrons of my podcast, $3 patrons. Bill, you were like looking at me in disdain. I could tell. But there's a point to it. The ebook is a collection of lessons that I've learned from people that I've interviewed over the years. And one of the chapters is on Adam Carolla, you know, the comedian and podcaster.
Now I'm looking at you with disdain.
And the lesson is be willing to do stuff for free. Adam talks about how his friends in high school who ended up being losers, they wouldn't do anything for free. And Adam would go to, he would pay to go to Groundlings classes, you know, to learn improv. He would pay to go to the Acme school or whatever. He would go to open mic nights and do them for free, you know, or you don't get paid anything to, and he says even now, as a famous dude, half the stuff he does, and maybe it's writing a screenplay that never gets produced, maybe it's writing a book proposal, maybe it's taking a meeting that doesn't go in, but half the stuff he does is for free. And and literally you and I were just texting, mm-hmm. you know, a half hour ago, and I told you you said that you were sort of helping me out with a column yesterday, giving me some ideas with something I was working on, and you said, you know, one of the side benefits of that conversation we had was that it sparked an idea in you. And I said, this is why we can never stop doing the DMZ, because even if we don't get paid, even if nobody listens or watches, I think these conversations actually result, we do it for free, but they result in these like unforeseen benefits.
Oh, sure. And I don't know about you, Matt. You know, I'm in my hermetically sealed bubble in Western Massachusetts. I'm not part of the Washington D.C. conversation on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis. You know, you get a certain amount of, you know, creative juices flowing just watching the news or following your Twitter feed, seeing what other people are saying and thinking about what you could add to the conversation. But there's something about actually having an actual conversation with somebody that can, you know, trigger thought.
I think there is I'm sure scientists would back this up, but it seems to me that you can think about things and write about things, but there's something about talking that sparks different neurons in your brain. Like when I was writing my book, I've told this story before, but when I was writing Too Dumb to Fail, got to the end, it's like it's August, and the book just wasn't quite right. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the problem was structural. People don't think about this. You think about writing a book. You think about a lot of things. Like, but the one thing you don't think of is, like, is it really in the right order? Should there be – how does it flow? Should – you know, each chapter should sort of build on something. And but I just couldn't put my finger on it. And so I – my wife and I were in Arizona, and we're going to hike Pinnacle Peak Mountain. And my idea was we're going to walk up this mountain – I was going to tell her the problem, and she was going to tell me the answer. So we're walking, we're hiking up this mountain. The sun's beating down. It's like 100 degrees. I'm physically exercising. We're walking. And the whole way up, I'm just bitching to my wife about this book, and I'm ranting with the expectation that she's going to tell me how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And she just kept her mouth shut and let me keep talking. We hiked all the way up. Then we start hiking all the way down, and I'm talking it. I'm just telling her. I'm just bitching about what's wrong. By the way, let me say a total aside. Patreon is deplatforming me. They just listed my my page as adult content.
Oh, jeez.
Can you believe that?
Anyway, I can't fathom what you could have done to have awarded that.
This is me. It's now listed. Of course, I'm appealing. So if you know anybody, if you know any of the overlords at Patreon, let me know how to fix it. But anyway, back to my story. So I bitch all the way up. Maybe it's words like bitch. I don't know. But I'm using it, I think, in a context that is politically correct. I rant. I complain all the way up Pinnacle Peak Mountain and all the way halfway down, expecting my wife to have the solution. And at some point, I have these two epiphanies of how to fix the book. And Bill, I would tell you, I believe I could have sat in front of my laptop for a million years and racked my brain, and I would not have come up with the solution. But it was, I think, walking and talking that did it.
So let us discuss what we talked about.
Okay.
When this is all coming out of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and you talked about both Cory Booker's release of certain emails, though there's some confusion what he released that was committee confidential and what was no longer committee confidential. I think there's some of both in there. And also Kamala
Committee
Harris.
Committee Confidential was the original title of the Anthony Bourdain book. And luckily they changed it.
And also Kamala Harris's questioning of Kavanaugh in regards to conversation he may or may not have had with someone at a law firm that's tied to Trump regarding the Mueller investigation. You were critical in your column of Booker and Harris's behavior on the committee.
Yeah, I was. I mean, it just seems to me that they're auditioning to be the Democratic nominee. They're trying to one up each other, and it was weird. I mean, Kamala Harris, of course, went through this line of questioning, suggesting that that Kavanaugh was basically lying about whether or not he had a conversation with someone from the law firm of Donald Trump's attorney about Robert Mueller. It was a weird thing, and I think her confidence and the line of questioning suggested that she had receipts, that she was trying to either have a gotcha moment or entrap him into lying, and then she would produce evidence or proof that he had had some sort of presumably inappropriate conversation. At the time of this taping, I'm not aware that any of that evidence has actually surfaced, and it struck me as very, very weird and perhaps overzealous. The Cory Booker thing was likewise weird. The I Am Spartacus moment was just bizarre. And I think part of it is that there's a sense that that Donald Trump has broken norms and he's broken rules, and we need to fight fire with fire. So we need to break norms and we need to break rules. I just don't think it works for most people. Like, when Marco Rubio tried to like fight fire with fire, it didn't work, and I don't think it works when Cory Booker does it.
Well, I think the Harris and the Booker examples are different. I mean,
sure.
Harris isn't breaking a norm by having a tough interrogation.
Well, I don't know if she was breaking a norm, but like, it's not just a tough interrogation. It was, I mean, maybe something's, look, it's totally possible that we'll finish this up and Kamala Harris will produce something.
So they had a follow-up exchange where it seemed like she didn't have the something.
And I think that's weird. Like, there are tough interrogations, but I don't remember where someone essentially went down a line of questioning, which seemed to suggest that there was something very damning that there was evidence of that just ended up going nowhere. Is it just me, or was that really bizarre?
I mean, the first exchange, it really seemed like she had some goods.
Yeah.
And she wanted to make him stew in it for a while.
Yeah.
And see how he would do. And then the next day, he said more flatly, no, I didn't have a conversation with someone at that law firm. And she was like, all right. So I don't know if she's got a third act on
the
score.
I mean, I guess it's possible that it was just psychological warfare, trying to rattle him. It's possible that she was I'm trying to think of the word that would be appropriate, but that it was sort of like, well, interrogation is the right word in the sense that there are times where the police want you to think they know something, right? They want you to think that they know something that they actually don't know. And it's like, we already know, so go ahead and tell us, right?
Right.
Maybe that's what she was up to, but I don't, it struck me as bizarre, and it struck me as overzealous, and I think that they're both doing this because they're in this invisible Democratic primary, but I would actually argue that it's not really going to help them in the long run.
Well, let me shift to the Booker thing, and I want to circle back to what you're saying. I mean, I don't think it is wrong for Booker and the other Democrats. It really wasn't just Booker. I mean, all the Democrats were complaining that Grassley was making these emails committee confidential needlessly. And even though they were eventually releasing them to be discussed publicly, it was slow-walked. They're dumping a whole bunch of documents, you know, a few hours before the committee starts. They can't really have time to sift through it all. It seemed to be sort of designed to keep Democrats off balance. I don't know what I can ask or what can I talk about. If I don't know, I can talk about this email. I'm not going to prepare a line of questioning. Oh, now I can? Well, maybe I don't have the questions at the ready then and really bore into certain issues now. So I don't think it's illegitimate to call attention to that, to have a protest of it.
Sure.
I mean, as Cory Booker said, it was a form of civil disobedience. I mean, Booker said first, this is civil disobedience.
He's Rosa Parks for doing what he did. You know, it's come on. Look, I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I agree with you. I think Booker was being excessively histrionic about it.
Yes.
And that speaks to the invisible 2020 primary. But in and of itself, I don't think it is wrong for Democrats to say, I'm going to break a technical rule to make a point, and if that means there is some kind of reprimand for me down the line, I'll accept that. I mean, that is, so the principle of civil disobedience is, I know I'm breaking a law or a rule, and I know I'm going to get a consequence for it.
Right.
And I will accept that consequence to make a larger point. I mean, I think that can be an honorable thing to do. I don't think Booker needed to do it in such a grandstanding way. I think the fact they did it in a grandstanding way speaks to what you're getting at. And this is what I want to write about, which I haven't written the piece yet, but I'm chewing on it. Keep in mind that 2 days before this, I believe it was 2 days, Michael Avenatti, had a tweet where he said, whoever's the Democratic nominee should pledge to propose 2 more justices to the Supreme Court. And mind you, Avenatti has said publicly he is considering a run himself.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps you shouldn't take that seriously because he has no credentials to be president. But then again, look who's president today.
I take it seriously.
I mean, he's certainly he is going to Iowa and New Hampshire, yeah. And he's talking like he's an
And I think part of my – I don't know if my column at the Daily Beast – I'm not sure I actually was able to really make this point. But part of my argument is that Harris and Booker are normal politicians. And they are expediting or aiding the transformation of our politics into a Trumpian ethos. And they think they can control it. They think that they can basically co-opt the zeitgeist. And I think by breaking down the norms, it's more likely that they end up with Michael Avenatti, actually.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't think Avenatti would be the nominee. And, of course, I thought Donald Trump would be the nominee. So you can say, what the hell does Bill Sheridan know? That's fine. I think the bigger impact here is if Avenatti is running as the guy who's going to be the most effective norm breaker, the most ferocious fighter in the procedural war.
Yep.
That shifts the center of gravity of the entire field potentially. So we've already been expecting the center of gravity to shift policy wise, largely because of Bernie Sanders, maybe to some lesser extent Elizabeth Warren, but I think Bernie is really has the pole position there. So when Bernie says, I'm for single payer, all of a sudden, I mean, this goes for Warren too, people who were not for single payer previously are so now. When Bernie says he's for a federal job guarantee, several other senators say, I'm for a federal job guarantee too. So you've already seen that dynamic go on.
It's the Overton window, and I would argue in the case of Avenatti, it's a race to the bottom.
Well,
it's an arms race. Like once somebody says, "I'm not going to abide by the rules of civility, I'm going to cheat," everyone has to, right?
And now
that's the assumption. Now I think maybe you go the other direction. Maybe you do counter programming. Maybe you're like, well, people are going to want the opposite of Trump
I can talk about this later, but you know, Joe Biden in his eulogy for McCain, you know, he is almost being the standard bearer for norms.
Except yesterday he called somebody a bad word. I'm not gonna say it because I don't want Patreon to tag this with an adult contact label. But I read that Joe Biden referred to a tracker by a derogatory name yesterday.
Well, I don't think that rises to the level of trying to erode the norms of democracy. That you got a little angry at somebody, but I mean, not just in the McCain eulogy. He's been on this point for a long time that we need to get back to where we were, where we might question someone's judgment but not their motive. You know, we need to work together. We need to find common ground. All that kind of goody-goody bipartisan stuff. Biden is the most vocal champion of at this point in the Democratic Party. Avenatti is going, 180 degrees the other way. And when Booker and Harris did what they did, Avenatti was on Twitter kind of needling them.
Yeah, I think so. It's a subtweet, or it's like sort of trolling. It was unclear to me. I took it that he was needling them.
I think it was basically, you know, you guys better have the goods if you're doing this.
Well, no, what he said was, I'm sure she has the goods because you would never go down this line of questioning unless you had the evidence.
But the follow-up tweet was, because if you don't, dot, 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 or something
right,
like that.
Right.
So I think he was very – I interpreted it as if you want someone who really knows how to throw a punch,
it's not these two,
it's me.
I don't think we know that for sure, but that's how I interpreted it as well. Let me say a couple quick things about Cory Booker. Three quick things. One is, I think that part of what made Donald Trump appealing to people that he appealed to isn't just that he's a fighter, that's part of it, but also that he was authentic. I don't think Cory Booker comes across as authentic when he fights. It goes against his brand, and I don't think it works. I think it makes him seem like a phony, and that's the opposite of the lesson that should have been learned from Trump. Number two, you know, look, there is a time for civil disobedience. I think the standard for that should be kind of a rare occurrence, and we also have something called the rule of law. And if you can just unilaterally decide which rules and policies and laws you are going to follow and which you aren't, it's hard to have a civilization. And I see a parallel here to the story we're going to talk about later, having to do with the New York Times op-ed that someone just decided they would write.
But true civil disobedience accepts rule of law. It says, I am breaking the law knowing I'm going to be penalized under the law for it, and I'm not going to complain about that consequence. But that's true civil disobedience. That's the civil part of it.
Fair point. My last point is how Corey, I don't know if he botched it or if it just didn't work, but it was weird because he made this big hoopla about how brave he was. But it turns out that, number one, the information that he was demanding everyone see made Judge Kavanaugh look really good and prove that he was not, in fact, a racist.
Well, you're speaking specifically to the racial profiling chain of emails. And I think, Booker wasn't trying to say these emails are a smoking gun that proves Brett Kavanaugh's a racist. He was trying to say this whole process of bottling up these emails is not a fair process.
It's just an interesting hill to die on.
Well, I agree with
that. And then the other part, as you know, Bill, is that I don't know if Booker was aware of this or not, but apparently that document or that information had already been technically cleared or was being cleared. So he was making this big demonstration about how brave he is and he's the civil disobedience to release information that A, made Kavanaugh look good, and B, wasn't actually committee confidential anyway.
Yeah, I think it was right to press the Republicans. It was right to, you know, leak some of these documents before the formal declassification to illustrate the point. You didn't need to do the extra level of grandstanding, which is now obscuring. I mean, because there's one document that does have some real import from a Democratic perspective, which is the one about Roe v. Wade. The racial profiling chain shows Kavanaugh expressing a desire for, in the wake of 9/11, a race-neutral way to, check airline passengers.
Right.
He did not want to racially profile airline passengers. There's a little bit of a gray area. It was like, I don't know what we're going to do in the interim here. We need to grapple with that. But my long-term goal is a set of policies that is race-neutral. But the Roe v. Wade email shows him questioning a draft op-ed which says that it's widely accepted amongst legal scholars that Roe v. Wade has set a law. And he was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, I don't think it's fair to say that all legal scholars say that. And the three Supreme Court justices who we know would overturn it. And a Supreme Court judge has the power to overturn precedent. So it's just a wee bit short of Kavanaugh saying himself, I think it's not settled law and I wish I could overturn it. But the fact that he would raise that flag, I heard this on the New York Times podcast. I didn't read the initial draft
By
email
the way,
itself. So
let me just say, that daily podcast they have,
yeah,
is amazingly good.
Oh, it's a great podcast.
I love it. Very good.
But my understanding is that the original wording of that draft.ed was that it was widely accepted, and that Kavanaugh's response was, hey, it's not all legal scholars, which isn't even the same thing. I mean, you could acknowledge that there's some minority of legal scholars that says it's not subtle law, but it's widely accepted still. The fact that Kavanaugh wanted to push that point suggests where his bias and perspective comes from. Now, it's not quite a smoking gun, but it certainly raises a lot of questions. So there's no need to make that a confidential document. It should be in the public domain, and he should be asked about it. So we're not talking about that as much as we could be because we're caught up in this whole other drama.
Right. Well, and because I think Cory Booker botched his stunt, and because he felt compelled to try to get to try to please, you know, liberal fans on Twitter and to have a moment in a TV clip, you know,
And so this does raise the question for the rest of the primary: are we going to be fighting over who is going to break the most norms, who is going to push the envelope the most? And I don't think Democrats need to be strictly goody two shoes all the time, and you know, all's fair and you know, love, war, and politics. There's plenty of times when politicians on both sides throw sharp elbows and do things out of partisan self-interest and get away with it just fine. And that is within the realm of democracy that it's fine. But you do risk that race to the bottom situation where if both parties are perceived as completely disregarding of political norms, where is that going to leave, you know, the bonds of democracy?
Right. And that's bad for liberal democracy, bad for America. Also, it's no way to peel off people like me or people who are, I mean, that's clearly not the goal, but there may be people who don't like Trump who might be gettable. Maybe they're not as conservative as I am. But maybe they'll vote for Biden, probably not going to vote for Kamala, probably, who knows, even Avenatti might be able to get them. I tell you, I think what the model that Cory Booker and Harris are employing reminds me more of what Ted Cruz would have done. Like if Ted Cruz and Rand Paul were jockeying for position to be president, this is the kind of thing that they would have done. Well, guess who isn't in the White House right now?
Now, the other big drama of the week is the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times.
Yes.
What one could see a Assistant Secretary Matt Lewis writing an op-ed like this.
No, I wouldn't do anything that stupid.
Maybe you wouldn't do it anonymously. Maybe you wouldn't do it in that way. But the sentiment expressed, which is, we're stuck with this guy as president. I know he's terrible. I know he's destroying all these norms. I know he has these authoritarian impulses. But we're doing our best to keep it contained, and we're at least giving you tax cuts to judges. Please give us a pat on the back for that. That's kind of where you are politically.
Well, I think it would have been – that op-ed would have been a fine column written by Matt Lewis in the New York Times, not by someone who works in the administration. I mean, look, I think there are two honorable ways to go about this if you're that person. They could, number one, go public, publicly resign and say, this is why I'm doing it. This guy's unfit. Option two, be – you know, put your head down, stealthily try to protect the country, try to move things in a more sane way, and don't telegraph what you're doing.
But I
see potential negative ramifications from this op-ed. I actually don't see anything positive. Like, he did alert the public to stuff we already knew.
And you're assuming like we don't know it's a he.
That's true. Or maybe we do know who it is.
I mean,
maybe one of us.
Just percentage wise of that administration, it's a good chance it's a he. But
I'm
going to
say
know.
He. I think that this person just telegraphed to the president and made the president more paranoid. But I don't know what good comes out of it. You know, the American public, I think, already knew. Look, either you love Donald Trump or you don't, but I don't think there was a lot of information revealed that that, you know, I know that Donald Trump is capricious. I know that he has bad policies regarding tariffs. I mean, none of this was a surprise. It just confirmed what I already know. So either go public, blow the whistle, or work to keep the country together. But I don't see the benefit of this.
Well, I think that that's worth exploring. Why did this person choose number three? He didn't resign. Yeah. He or she did not resign because the whole point of the article is we should not resign, those of us who are resisting from the inside. We think there's more value staying inside and containing him than quitting. That's the point.
You can only hope to contain him. It's like Hootie and the Blowfish.
But if your strict objective is to contain him and make him none the wiser about what you're doing,
why
would you tell the world? So on its face, the objective does not jibe with the execution.
Right. And then the other option is you have an ulterior motive, which is to like get famous and make a name for yourself, but then why do it anonymously?
Well, I think that could well be the objective. I mean, you do it anonymously, you spark a whole guessing game, yeah. You get smoked out in a week, and then you're going to do a giant media tour and get a book deal.
Good
maybe.
Day. Remember the Flight 93 guy?
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Yeah, Michael Anton.
Michael Anton. He's at Hillsdale College now.
He was in the administration briefly.
He was in the administration. He got hired after being outed for writing that piece at Claremont.
So it could be part of a individual self-promotion scheme.
That's a long game. It's devious. It could work.
It could be that there is a broader revolt, you know, brewing inside the administration, and this is just the tip of the spear. Then, and in that respect, the literal substance of the op-ed is not as relevant as what might come next. Are there more shoes to drop here? What people are going to do, and are they not trying to stabilize the administration?
Right.
Are they trying to destabilize the administration to open the door up for a primary challenge or a third party candidacy?
I don't think that. I will say this. Look, the larger, you know, hardest hit by this is Bob Woodward, apparently, right? Who has a book basically saying a lot of the same things, who is now being overshadowed by this parlor game of who wrote.
He's still going to sell a lot of books.
He'll be fine. I'm not worried about that kid's going to make it.
And it's not contradictory. I mean, this sort of bolsters Michael Wolff's credibility. You know, people.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't so sure about this 25th Amendment discussion in his book because he talked about it. I mean, when he was on air being interviewed, he kind of talked about as if people were kind of cracking jokes about 25th Amendment, and you weren't sure if Wolf was putting some extra spin on it by making it seem like every day it's being discussed in all corners of the White House. Is this the day that we go 25th Amendment? And now you got a person, a nominee, saying, oh, yeah, we talked about it. We certainly talked about it.
Michael Wolf's book, although a lot of people ended up seeing it as unreliable, it brought down Steve Bannon, the senior advisor to the president. So that book had ramifications. Who knows what Woodward's book may have.
Even Omarosa's book, you know, I mean, it's all part of the same narrative. I mean, and you might say, I can't trust every line of Omarosa's book or every line of Mike Wolff's book because they don't have established credibility. And look, even Woodward, I mean, people are treating him now as if he's, you know, golden because he certainly is relative to Trump. But there's always a critique on the left of Woodward that even if he didn't, you know, misquote people, you know, the individual facts of the books might be fine, but how he put them together, how he elevated individuals that gave him the most access might give you an overall skewed picture.
Sure.
And that could well be the case with this book, too.
Absolutely.
Where Gary Cohn looks more like a hero because he talked to Bob Woodward, just to speculate.
That's an incentive for talking to Woodward on his next book.
That's right. But all of these things, whatever their individual flaws or potential flaws might be, they're all saying the same narrative, the op-ed included.
Which we all have known. I mean, no big surprise, in my opinion. Donald Trump is who we thought he was. And he's been Donald Trump for 30 or 40 years at least, maybe 70. Now, let me just say this, though, about the Woodward book. One of the danger of the Woodward book is that General Mattis gets fired or pushed out, right? The way that H.R. McMaster has been.
Or Chief of Staff Kelly.
Right. It could be, definitely. And then the people like yours truly, I have written and I've been saying that I think decent, good people should separate themselves from Trump, with the exception of people like General Mattis, who I really want to be there, okay? And I think the first response to Woodward's book is that that's absolutely right. Like, thank God that General Mattis is there, that he's sort of taking one for the team. He is keeping Trump from doing horrible things. But I wonder, what would happen if General Mattis went public? What if, now he's a, you know, he's a Marine. I don't want to say soldier, but he's a Marine. He follows orders. He knows chain of command, all that. But what if he were to go public and say to the American people, I have a higher call, I have a higher duty, and this guy's insane.
And resigns?
Publicly. Mattis goes public. Mm-hmm. And resigns, yes, resigns and says, everything in this book is true. What would happen? That I don't know. Is he better off, keeping the world from exploding, being inside the tent? Or would it be more honorable for him, even for him, to go public, resign, and blow the whistle?
I mean, I feel he's already made his call. He went in knowing who he was dealing with and made the decision that it's better for me to be inside than outside. So you might as well follow through on your initial plan. And so when you're judged in the eyes of history, people can say, this is what this guy did to prevent nuclear war or prevent some wider regional conflict somewhere. To shift gears in the middle, because you got smoked out by Woodward, seems like more of just sort of self-preservation, as opposed to sticking with what your initial belief system guided you to do.
Yeah, well, right or wrong, I think that's what he's going to do.
Let me ask you one more political question about this.
Yeah,
could it be that the person or persons behind the op-ed want to communicate to, never Trump Republicans or Trump skeptical Republicans, hey, we're making the best of this. You don't need to break ranks here. You don't need to abandon the Republican Party in the midterms and hand the Congress to the Democrats because the check and balance is happening inside the room.
That's such a bank shot. I mean, I think if your goal was to make that point, you should make that very explicitly, because the notion that we're going to like read that op-ed and that's going to be our takeaway is not a high percentage. I just don't think that Donald Trump is going to have a real challenge. And I mean, I think there are a handful of people right now that I think are really good. Nikki Haley, Ben Sasse, Marco Rubio, Tim Scott. If Nikki Haley wanted to do this, that she should have resigned the day that Trump was in Helsinki and launched her campaign. I don't know if she could. I think it's still highly unlikely she would have been able to wrest control the nomination from Trump. But I think that would have given her an excuse to have served in the administration and to have turned on the guy who hired her. She would have had a valid excuse had she done it that day, seized that moment, and begun running. But look, I mean, I'm not saying that nobody's going to primary Donald Trump.
I mean, Kasich's going to, right?
He's going to, probably, right? But who cares? He doesn't have, I don't even, I don't even like John Kasich.
Now, you mentioned Rubio before. How did you feel about you always had been partial to Rubio, although you I think you at a certain point realized that he wasn't living up to expectations. Did he get some mojo back going toe-to-toe with Alex Jones?
I thought he did, I have to say. I thought that he really comported himself well. Look, people who are not in, you know, I don't think any of us understand what it would be like if someone, Bill, like, let's just say that if someone came up to you all of a sudden and stuck a camera in your face and started asking you questions and heckling you, how would you respond? It's a weird thing to have happen to you, right? And there's, if you sort of run away, you could look weak, you could overreact and get into a fight with the person, and then you look like the bad guy. There's a lot of ways for that to go wrong, and I don't think people realize how difficult of a position you're in when someone does that, when they kind of ambush you like that and heckle you. And Alex Jones did that to Rubio, and I thought Rubio handled it great. He rolled his eyes. He kind of laughed. He did the most cruel thing Rubio could have done is say that he had no idea who Alex Jones was.
You think that's true?
I don't believe for a minute, but I think – look, let me just say this. Let's dispel the myth that Marco Rubio didn't know what he was doing. Marco Rubio knew exactly what he was doing. Let's dispense with the myth there. But – no, Rubio, of course, knew who he was, but it's really the best way to insult an egomaniac. And the funny thing is how Alex Jones is like, 10 million listeners, 10 million downloads, more followers than Rush Limbaugh. You know, I mean, like, he had his pride wounded. He had to, like, he couldn't, like, let that hang. He had to be defensive about it. I thought Rubio, look, it's a small thing, in a week full of bizarre stories. It was one small thing that I think was positive. I think Rubio handled himself well. What did you think, though, of this?
I thought he handled himself fairly well, but I think there's the bigger question. Are there people in the Republican Party who are going to say to the Alex Jones minions, we don't want you here. We don't want you to be part of this party. We have a president that flirts with you, is gone on your show.
I think Trump went on Alex Jones.
Right. You went on Jones' show in the campaign, and continues to, I believe he's echoed certain conspiratorial things, that come out of the show. You know, it's a question for the party going forward. Are we going to maintain this, you know, tacit alliance with the conspiracy-minded right? So for Rubio to have one exchange with him, I thought was good for Rubio. But I'm curious, is he going to go beyond this and say, look, we need to draw some lines here about what it means to be a Republican?
Yeah.
Because Trump's not going to be here forever. Obviously, they've made their devil's bargain for the time being, and I'm not expecting that to change anytime soon. But going beyond Trump, people have to make the party has to decide, are we going to stick with this model or are we going to break free of this?
Well, I have to say, I listened to our friend Jamie Weinstein, over at the Jamie Weinstein podcast, he's been asking, Trump people who come on his show what they think of Alex Jones and kind of getting them on the record. And he just had, who's that guy, Boris, from,
He's on Sinclair now.
Sinclair. He just asked.
Or Salem. Or it's Salem. Yeah,
okay. Sinclair.
Okay.
He just asked Boris, and Boris said he doesn't like Alex Jones, and he doesn't like conspiracy. He doesn't follow. Boris actually used the word conspiracy theories. And who's this guy, Charlie from Turning Points USA? Charlie. By the way, I'm not doing what Rubio did to Alex
Kirk?
Jones.
Is it Kirk?
Charlie Kirk. Yeah. Jamie Weinstein also had Charlie Kirk on the podcast, and Charlie Kirk distanced himself. And I think Candace Owens, who is a colleague of Charlie's, had been on or had said some good things about Alex Jones, or had been on his show maybe. But Charlie was distancing. So I think there are Republicans now.
Are these folks saying, because Twitter just banned Alex Jones from the platform? So,
yes.
Is Jones banned now from YouTube and Twitter?
I think so.
And Facebook?
I think so.
So
And he's been what the kids call deplatformed.
Right. So if you're going to go on air now and accuse Silicon Valley of deplatforming conservatives because they deplatform Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Or even if you don't use Alex Jones's name, if you're being vague enough for people to assume that's what you mean.
Yeah.
That's playing both sides of the fence.
Well, let me just say, Alex Jones, he's broken the rules. Now, maybe it's an act of civil disobedience. I can't say. But he's broken their rules. They can do what they want. They are a company. I think he has broken the rules. Now, I would say a more of a martyr of this cause would be me. Is it a coincidence that I write a piece criticizing Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, and suddenly my Patreon page is flagged for adult content? I can't say if it is or not. I can't say if that's a coincidence. I don't know. But the conservatives out there, you know, first they came for Matt Lewis. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not going to compare myself to heroes, but this is concerning.
But the principled conservative argument is these are private corporations. Yeah. And we should not regulate what private corporations do as far as who they allow on their platforms. That would be a free market conservative position. If you're going to make a free speech case in an application to the private sector, that to me is violating conservative principles to kowtow to the conspiracy right.
Sure, but you have to understand that a lot of the people in the so-called conservatives today, this is not the only example of them not adhering to free market conservative philosophy. I mean, this, you know, the Laura Ingrams, the Steve Bannons, the Donald Trumps of the world are not free market purists. Mm-hmm. And they are making an argument that these social media platforms are now a utility, and that, you know, the power to, you know, label my Patreon page an adult page is the power to destroy. Mm-hmm. And that if let's just be honest for a second. If you can't be on Twitter at this point, that's a significant limitation of your ability to communicate in the 21st century. I think we'd agree on that.
Well, I don't totally agree on that. If you don't like those companies because you don't like their policies for admittance, and you believe in the free market, then you should say, I'm going to go out and be an entrepreneur and build a different platform with different sets of rules and policies and make that a more appealing platform. And if you can't do that, maybe your idea isn't good enough. I mean, Donald Trump, this is somewhat of a tangent. You know, Donald Trump took the NFL, which was almost universally embedded in the American fabric, and single-handedly, you know, helped.
I think the NFL helped do that too.
But he made conservatives turn on the NFL, which you would never think possible. Because they can make conservatives turn on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube if they want to, and bring them to a conservative-minded social media platform where they can send their message out to like-minded people. Nothing's stopping them from doing that.
Yeah, no, I think the argument would be, and I'm a free market guy, but let me, you know, I'm going to engage in a little, you know, push back a little bit and engage in a little hypotheticals here. Okay, so if Twitter is like a TV channel, you can say, we'll just change the channel. I don't like what's on the mainstream media, but now I can start Fox News. But if Twitter's more like TV itself, the entire medium of TV, or, you know, now that is regulated.
Well, broadcast TV is government regulated. Right. You have to get spectrum from the government, so there's barriers to entry there. But the whole point of the internet is that it's not like that.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying, I'm not saying that it should be regulated, but at some point, does Twitter become, it's not a monopoly, but does it dominate the market so much that it is the idea that you could operate around it and build a better mousetrap is not feasible, not viable, because they have so much control of the marketplace that if you are shut out, practically speaking, if you are shut out of Twitter, your ability to speech is dramatically limited.
I think it's giving Twitter way too much credit. It's not that dominant. I mean, Facebook's much bigger than Twitter. I mean, you probably make a better argument in terms of Facebook and Twitter in that regard.
Okay. In the case of Alex Jones, he has been deplatformed from, I think, all of them.
Well, yes, he has. So. but nevertheless, he has an email list, I'm sure. He has his own website. He has tools at his disposal. I mean, Glenn Beck left Fox News to start his own media empire, his own TV station, and his radio show.
How's that going? How's that going for him?
He's making a living. He's not broke.
Okay. He was on the cover of Time Magazine once.
If I want to hear Glenn Beck's speech, I can get it. It is available to me.
My podcast is available to everybody too, but I don't know that it's going to necessarily drive the conversation.
That's on the quality of your speech, the quality of the product you're offering the public. If Glenn Beck is not reaching as many people as he did before, that's the market speaking. That's not someone censoring him.
I'm not sure that's right. I'm not saying he's being censored, but there are people. Can we agree that there are people on Fox News who have a bigger audience than I do or you do, who are not producing quality content, but they have a bigger megaphone because they are
producing a product that many people want to consume.
I'm not even sure that's true. But anyway, this is like a dorm room debate at this point. So I don't know where we go from there.
Well, I want to get back to work. I want to finish this piece that I was talking to you about. We're almost at an hour anyway.
Okay. Well, good show.
Good show. We didn't get a chance to talk about it, but check out my piece in Real Clear Politics, Joe Biden, Master of Grief, about how not just the McCain eulogy, but his history of eulogizing and his willingness to share his personal tragedies publicly may help him transcend political polarization and impact the 2020 race. So do check that out. So what do you got to talk about, Matt?
I don't like to plug stuff here. I just don't think it's appropriate. So I got nothing.
Except your ebook.
Well, I do have a new ebook. I don't like to talk about myself. I don't like to talk about these projects. But it's pretty nice. It's good. Get the ebook.
Now, I
put a lot of time into it.
Now, you did this seminar at the Leadership Institute the other day. Is that available online anywhere?
I don't know. I do know that I know it was available to watch when it was broadcast live. I do not know if the video is available.
You might want to contact the Leadership Institute. It was a long seminar on how to be a pundit.
Yeah, it was like 7 hours or
so
something.
So call the Leadership Institute. Say you want to purchase it, that you were so excited, you want to get this content. I'm sure they would. I'm not sure. Maybe they'll find a way to accommodate.
It's called the Opinion Leaders Workshop, and I actually learned stuff from doing it from the students, and it was basically like everything I know about how to do what I do, I shared, and it was also very grueling on my voice.
Right. It's like this master class. There's these master class videos. You can be a comedian. You can be a screenwriter.
Basically, what it was. And then it was like a workshop where I, for lack of a better word, lectured with a PowerPoint. And then I would interview people. So I had Shoshana Weissman come in, who's sort of a social media maven. And I would interview her about how to get big on Twitter and memes and stuff. And then the audience could ask her questions. Then I would talk about how to get a book deal. And then my book agent, Matt Latimer from Javelin, came in. He's also did James Comey's book, Donna Brazile's book, Tucker Carlson's book, Ben Sasse's book. And he came in and I interviewed him about how do you get on the bestseller list? And then the students could ask him a question. And then I did one on how to get on TV, how to get booked on TV as a TV pundit, and then how to get a contract. And then I had Alice Stewart, who is a CNN commentator and also was a communications director for, I think, Ted Cruz, Michelle Bachmann, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum. And so she has experience like getting herself booked on TV and getting candidates booked. And so I interviewed her, and then the students could ask her questions. So it was a really top-notch. I mean, if I could have taken this class 5 years ago, it would have saved myself a lot of time. I can tell you that.
All right. So check that out if possible, and we'll catch you here next week at the DMZ.
All right. See you guys.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.